The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Amateur Traveler Podcast, Episode 63. Today, the Amateur Traveler Podcast goes trekking in the Himalayas. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. This episode is brought to you by Hotelbook.com, the official site of independent hotels worldwide. Hotelbook.com, stay your way, stay independent. I have three news stories for you this week. The first one starts with bad news, and this is going to seem a little odd considering that this story, the interview this week, is going to be talking about India, but it seems only fair to tell you that there's some concerns with tourism to India because of outbreaks of dengue fever. Dengue fever and then a second mosquito-borne illness called chikungunya, and I don't know if I've got that pronunciation correct. There have been 103 deaths of dengue fever and 5,700 cases, so there's some concerns that that will curtail tourism to India, as you might imagine. Links to that story in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. In the odd news category, for those of you who are old enough like me to remember trying to travel on a plane with smoking sections and non-smoking sections, there is a German entrepreneur who plans a smoking airline. So an airline where basically the whole thing is a smoking airline. And if you're not able to smoke aboard your plane and yet you smoke, this might be something you're interested in. And for those of us who are non-smokers and we're so glad when they ban smoking, I suspect we will probably stay away. Links again to that article in the show notes. And then in an interesting article, one particular airline, Sky Europe, is now offering discount carrier rates within Europe that are negative. They will actually pay you a small amount to fly. That's right, they will pay you a small amount, less than 10 kroner or $0.44, so 44 cents. Qualifying travel dates are November 1st through December 15th and January 9th through March 24th of next year. You need to book by Sunday, October 21st. So this is an act now sort of thing. If you are one of those people who doesn't listen to your podcast till later, I'm sorry. Normally we jump right into the interview at this time. I'm going to beg your indulgence to tell you a couple new things that I would normally put at the end of the show. One is there is a potential new theme song for the show that's been written for the show. If you want to have any feedback before I start using it, I'll put links in the show notes and then also in the enhanced iTunes version of the show to a discussion board on amateurtraveler.com/board for that will show you where to find that theme song and then also have the commentary for the discussion about the theme song. Two is that this is an adventure travel episode of the podcast. And for those of you who are new listeners, and there are many of you, we alternate between domestic travel, international travel, adventure travel, and more normal means of travel. So I hope you enjoy this one. And this particular guest, Sam, wrote me using the email address that I advertise in every show, host@amateurtraveler.com, and this is just an invitation to let you know that I am looking for travel stories. And Sam's was a good story, and that's how he got on the show. So let me know. Put something on the discussion boards or write me if you want to hear your story here and be famous with your friends and relatives, at least. If any of you who have been listening to the show just a short period of time have any questions also about how to subscribe to the show and get it automatically every week, just let me know, same email address, host@amateurtraveler.com. And now, here's the interview. I'd like to welcome the show Sam Oppenheim. And Sam wrote me recently about a trip that he took trekking in the Himalayas. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure.
And Sam lured me with pictures, which always works. Sent me very beautiful pictures. Sam, you are a photographer, and you, I think you were saying that one of these days you're even thinking about doing that professionally? Or
that's right.
Solely professionally?
Well, probably not. Currently I'm a public school teacher, which gives me about 3 months a year when I'm not working. So that's when I do my photography. And I have gallery shows, and I'm planning someday on getting published, so I'm definitely pushing for making photography a bigger part of my life, but probably not as my only job.
And we'll put links in the show notes to Sam's online gallery with some of the pictures. But Sam, this was your fourth trip to India, is my understanding.
That's correct.
Why keep going back to India? What's the draw?
It's a mixture of cultural reasons, spiritual reasons, and just I became enamored with the landscape and the people.
Okay.
So I went first in 2001, then I went again in 2002, then in 2003, and I had to take a break, and the first time I went back since then was this summer.
And this trip was to northern India, but you've also been to southern India as well.
Right. This trip was 2 months during my public school, you know, summer vacation. I spent 1 month in South India and the second month in North India. And since you already did a podcast on South India, I figure I'll concentrate on the Himalayas, which are really my favorite part of the whole country.
So in what region did you go to then in the Himalayas or in India? And I try to say Nepal. We had to record the introduction twice here. But you were in the Indian region of the Himalayas.
Right. I was in the Indian region of the Himalayas. It's very much like Tibet and Nepal. It's where Tibetan Buddhism is practiced and wasn't affected and destroyed by the communist takeover of Tibet. So it's kind of like you're in Tibet, but you're still actually technically in Kashmir, but not anywhere near the terrorist part. So it's
okay,
like
so
a little
in the,
corner of India.
In the western part of the northwestern part of India.
Right. Not too far from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Tibet and Nepal.
Okay. And the particular region you said was Ladakh. Do I have that right?
Ladakh. Yep.
And
the capital city of that region is Leh.
Okay.
And the way you get there is you either take 2 days by vehicle from any place that's, you know, kind of normally reachable by travel, or you fly in, which is what I did.
When you say normally reachable by travel, so where, if you went that route, how would you, where would you go that fly in that would be closer? Or not as close, rather.
Well, I mean, it's 3 days overland from Delhi, the capital of India, or 2 days overland from the other popular areas nearby, like Manali is a popular area in the Himalayas, or another place that's popular would be like Amritsar, the Golden Temple, which is at the border of Pakistan and India in Punjab. But basically, this is a very remote region. There's no train traffic, and the mountains are very, very high up, and the rivers run east to west. So you'd have to go through Pakistan almost to easily get there along a valley. So to go overland, you have to cross many mountain passes, which, of course, requires tons of switchbacks because, for some reason, the engineers haven't decided to build any tunnels yet. Therefore, it's much easier to fly in.
And is that a small plane, then, that you're flying in?
Yeah, but it's a commercial small plane.
Okay.
It's a jet, not a propeller plane.
And you stayed in a hotel when you were there? Or you, how? What were the lodging? You stayed in the same place for 2 months?
No, I was in the Ladakh region for 1 month. And of that time, 7 days I spent in my tent trekking. And the other 3 weeks I spent in two different hotels in Leh.
And
I was planning, actually, on staying there less time. But we were there during the monsoon, and there were some problems with the weather.
Okay, so you're going near the Kashmir region, and you're going during a monsoon. So how much planning did you do this for this ahead of time?
I actually did a lot of planning.
Okay.
I mean, I hadn't planned out what to see there yet, but I'd been thinking about doing this trip for a very long time. And one of my best friends lives in India, and he and I had been writing letters and talking about meeting up for this trip. So we knew the weather was going to be imperfect, but we figured that it's the Himalayas, and it should be fine.
Okay. Did it meet your expectation?
Well, the trip was amazing. Everything was wonderful. The people were great. The photographs were wonderful. The experience was amazing. But the weather was the worst on record for that region for the monsoon ever. We were actually stranded completely. Five of the bridges were knocked out, and we couldn't move or leave the region.
Oh, my. Wow. And so when you were trekking, you were going just the two of you, or were you in a larger group?
We were in a large group. I only knew him beforehand, but we befriended a bunch of other people there, and all of us went together. I guess there was six of us on the trek.
And how does one arrange that? So if I decided to pick up tomorrow and go to northern India, how do you arrange a group if you haven't done it ahead of time?
Well, India is very easy to travel in. You don't have to arrange it ahead of time, except for the plane tickets, which get booked about 2 months in advance. So if you wanted to go overland, you wouldn't have to book it more than a day or two in advance. Also, the time of year when you go is important because of the weather. I mean, the Himalayas, and especially this region where, you know, you're living at almost 4,000 meters, can be really, really cold. So the season I went is the most popular season.
Okay. And then when you got there, there's a central place where people who want to go trekking congregate?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Leh is the capital. It's where the airport is. So all of the tourists basically come in through Leh. And from there, you know, you have options of going to monasteries, gompas, you know, Buddhist Tibetan monasteries, mm-hmm. Natural types of tours with tour guides or trekking. There's in Leh itself, it's a pretty big city. Especially for the Himalayas. You know, they have everything you could want. There's hundreds of tourist agencies vying for your tourist dollars.
Okay.
Great shopping opportunities. You can stock up there on, you know, anything you need, but not anything you want. Like, they don't have, they might not have your favorite brand of such and such or whatever, but if you need something to go trekking, like, they do have shoes of, you know, high quality.
Okay.
But they might not have Timberlands.
Okay. And what was the biggest surprise for you on this trip? You've been to India three times before, so I would think a lot of it was expected.
Mm-hmm. I'd never been to, except for Dharamshala, where the Dalai Lama lives, I'd never been to a Buddhist region of India. So part of it was the cultural differences. I speak a little Hindi, and I couldn't really speak Hindi there to most of the people.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest surprise was probably the weather. I just had no idea it could be that bad. I had spent 1 month earlier in the monsoon in southern India, and I knew it would be bad, so I planned for it, you know. But in the Himalayas, I had no clue that it would be raining every day and it would be that cold in the middle of August. I mean, I kind of knew it might be that cold, but it was really kind of tough being stuck in the same city when I like to travel a lot. I like to move around and see places, even if I'm on foot trekking and you're not moving very far. I don't really like staying in the same place for more than a week. So having to stay there for two full weeks, being stuck, not being able to go very far because the bridges were destroyed and the weather was really bad, it was kind of difficult. In fact, the bridge from my area that my hotel was in to the center of town was falling down into the river slowly, and the army was there waiting for it to fall so they could build a new one.
Oh, my.
And you couldn't take taxis, so we had to always walk to town, which was fine. It was only, you know, 2 kilometers. But
and once you got out of town and you started trekking, did you have a particular goal in mind or a destination or direction even?
Well, there's a ton of trekking routes. I mean, it's one of the trekking capitals of India, but most of them were closed because of the rain and mudslides. So we ended up going for one of the only ones that was open. And so, yeah, we had a very specific route. We started from the city we were in, Leh, and we went up and over a mountain range down into a different valley. It's called the Nubra Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And we returned by vehicle over the highest motorable pass in the world called the Kardung La Pass. And lots of people actually go up there. One of the tourist things to do is to bring motorcycles and take it up and over the pass, which I think is kind of insane, but some people would probably say that, you know, trekking over the pass would be just as insane. So
you said you started in Leh at 4,000 meters. Did I get that right? So over,
yeah, actually, not quite 4,000 meters. It was the Leh's airport is at 3,400 meters.
Okay. But then
which is about 14,000 feet.
Up and over the pass. So how high are you climbing to get up and over the pass into the next valley?
Right. The pass was 5,400 meters.
Oh, wow. Okay. And you stayed there long enough to acclimate. So I've been at 11,000 feet and for just a day, and there's a lot of a lot of breathing without a lot of oxygen coming in. So you're up at over 15,000, 16,000 feet at that point. And so is
right.
this something that you would recommend, I would assume, only for people who are in pretty good shape?
Right. Well, I mean, my best friend in India who went with me, Shekhar, mm-hmm. is 43 years old and a father of two. And he's not in the best shape. And he was able to acclimate. But he's in fine shape. I mean, clearly you wouldn't want to bring someone who's in awful shape. But mm-hmm. they recommend in all the tourist books 3 days in Leh before you do any traveling outside of Leh so you can acclimate. You're not going to have any serious problems if you fly in and stay in your hotel and take short little walks. Altitude sickness doesn't usually kill you.
Right.
So you just get up there and you feel really tired when you walk around and mm-hmm. then slowly your body adjusts.
Interesting. And what was the highlight of the trip, or the highlights?
Well, one of the highlights was when, on my birthday, we were supposed to go on a special tour to this border region with China where there's like a 25-mile-long lake of the most amazing color blue, and the roads were still closed and the taxi company wouldn't take us there. So my friends arranged to go the opposite direction to some Buddhist monasteries across a broken bridge, and we took the car, got out, walked across the river, and then got another car on the other side of the broken bridge and drove to these monasteries that we'd been hearing about but nobody'd been seeing for the past week or two. So, you know, all the local tourists and all the people we were friends with were waiting till the road opened. And when we got there to one of them, we picked up a hitchhiking monk, and he brought us into the inner sanctum of the Buddhist monastery and showed us a giant sand mandala that they were just finishing. And if you've seen 7 Years in Tibet or Kundun or any Buddhist documentary, you know what I'm talking about. But it's a gigantic circular or square mandala that's made by Buddhist monks putting tiny grains of colored sand okay. in a specific pattern. And it takes them forever. I'm sure you can see a picture linked to this or at my website. And it's really, really amazing in person. I'd seen it in video, and I was like, I can't believe they're sitting there. It takes them 6 days to put this thing together.
Oh, my.
And the other highlight was probably crossing the pass, you know, being up at 5,400 meters, the highest I'd ever been. And it was a very tough climb, you know, that one day up and over the pass.
Mm-hmm. Tough because of the incline as well as just the altitude?
Right. Well, the night before, we'd all had some effects of altitude sickness. We were sleeping at 4,700 meters, and it was below freezing, so we hadn't had a good night's rest. And then we had to climb up and over the pass, which was just a whole bunch of switchbacks, and it started to snow on us, so... It was pretty intense. I'm sure you can link to a photograph of that as well. And it's it was amazing up there. I would recommend trekking in the Himalayas to anyone who feels up to it. It's not the first time I've gone trekking. It's the first time I've gone that high. And usually whenever I've been in India, and I've been there now for a total of 8 months, the highlight is almost always in the Himalayas. It's just a part of the world that is completely amazing, fresh, some of the newest mountains. They're really very different from the Rockies. And there's something amazing about them.
Any particular thing that stands out for you as a photographer?
Well, I've been to the Himalayas 3 times before.
Mm-hmm.
So this trip, I got better pictures in South India. But the thing that stood out the most in North India and the Himalayas for me as a photographer was the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was like being in Tibet or Nepal where I had never been. You know, if you look at the photographs, you'll see the people's faces. They look very Asian.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the Buddhist monks, they look like the Tibetan Buddhist monks. If you look at the architecture. So it's like taking a trip back in time to Tibet before China invaded.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, one of my other friends who's a public school teacher went to Tibet this summer, and she came back depressed from that. She said, you know, it's so nice and so wonderful in some ways, but it feels ruined by the overflow of Chinese and what they've done to change it. And that was a kind of a leitmotif I heard among other travelers who'd been to Tibet and as well.
Hmm. If other people are going to go and follow in your footsteps, what would you recommend? what advice would you give somebody who is going on this same sort of trip?
Well, I flew in and drove back. So that's the skeleton of my trip. It was recommended in the guidebooks. And it means that you get there quickly and easily, and you adjust to the altitude, and you can see the whole region doing whatever you want. But when I came back, it took 2 days crammed in a very uncomfortable vehicle, going over mountain roads that were the bumpiest roads I've ever been on.
You were in
but it was absolutely stunning.
You were in public transportation on the way back?
No, we rented a private car thinking it'd be fine, and it ended up tiring us almost more than trekking. Just, I'd never known that riding in a car could be that tiring. It's really painfully slow going, like something like, you know, 10 to 12 miles per hour on average, because of just sometimes traffic, road conditions. It's really, really painful going. Now, mind you, I did go when the bridges had just been repaired and the roads have a lot of rubble on them because, you know, this region, the mountains are eroding very quickly. And so, therefore, the road's also collapsing very quickly and frequently. And but it's worth it. I mean, the views from the car were stunning. Just absolutely amazing. I felt like I traveled through Utah, Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico. Like, I felt like I went on a road trip through all these great different kinds of canyon lands and badlands. The parts of it even looked like South Dakota, the Badlands region. So, although it would be much easier to fly in and fly out, there is something to be said for the drive. And then once you're there, like I said before, there's so many different activities. There's amazing shopping. I brought back some really nice red coral and turquoise jewelry. There's some people who do bike riding there. Even some people take the cars up to the highest motorable pass in the world at, 5,600 feet and then take their bikes down from that height back to the city. And it looks like a lot of fun.
You've read the guidebooks and you're prepared ahead of time. What did the guidebooks recommend that you would recommend against? Forget what the guidebook said. Skip it.
The guidebooks tell you that every gompa or monastery is amazing, and they make each one sound good. They're like, this one's good because of that, this one's good because of that. But you get really sick and tired of visiting Buddhist monasteries because they all start to seem the same. So you really need to pick out a few.
Okay.
And see those, and not try to see more than, you know, three or four in a day.
Sounds like my kid's impression of cathedrals in Europe, so, okay.
Yeah, pretty much the same idea.
And what did they leave out? What did you discover when you were there that the guidebooks didn't tell you anything about that was really something that we should know?
I don't think they mentioned picking up hitchhiking monks as a great way to get inside of the temples and have a more personal. We were in his bedroom drinking tea, and he was telling us about his life there and showing us his little tiny kitchen in the corner. I like to stop and talk to people as often as possible. Even when we're driving in the car, we saw some apricot sellers, and we just stopped and talked to them and went and got a cup of chai. So, you know, for me, one of the best parts of being in a foreign country is to try to talk to the people who you might otherwise drive past to get to whatever your destination is. Not that it's particularly surprising, but it really enriches your trip.
And as long as we're talking about talking to people, language, you said you couldn't use the Hindi, so you were mostly conversing in English or in charades, or...
Yeah, you know, I'd find usually most of the people knew a tiny bit of Hindi if they didn't know any English. Tourist charades works, you know, just smiling works pretty well. You know, they do live in India, so they all go to public schools, and they're either learning some Hindi or some English or both. So most of the children in the younger generation speak it, so especially the children are really easy to approach. With English, even, you know, they all want to learn English.
Sure. Anything that stands out from your time in the city when you were stuck there for 2 weeks?
Well, it was actually nice. You know, it was nice to slow down and stay with the same people. And we got to know the restaurants. The owners of the restaurants got to know us really well. We got to know where the really good food was in town. And Leh has a restaurant called Tibetan Kitchen, which we actually had to make reservations at, which is pretty unheard of in India, and it was worth it. That's something that I don't – my guidebook was from 2001, and I don't know – I don't think it was even in there except to say that it was good. So I'm not sure what it says in the current guidebook, but you need reservations, and it's worth it.
First of all, which guidebook were you using?
I usually use the Lonely Planet guidebook.
That was my guess, but okay.
I'm not sure if they're particularly better or not.
And that worked well for you?
Yeah. I mean, where Lonely Planet worked great, even though I was using one that was 5 years out of date.
Okay.
It's funny because everyone there has a Lonely Planet. And it's like you're walking around the street, you sit down to dinner, and every table has someone with a Lonely Planet guidebook. So.
And then in terms of the restaurants, what is the food like in northern India? Is it similar to what I think of as Indian food, or is it a different type of cuisine?
You can get what you think of as Indian food in North India, absolutely. But their cultural background is more like Nepal and Tibet. So they serve momos, which are like what we might call pot stickers or dumplings. And they serve them in soup, and they serve them fried, and they serve them boiled. And they serve sampa, which is that barley kind of relative that they make into kind of an oatmeal or a porridge, and they also make soups out of it.
Okay.
So, you know, half of the restaurants usually have sections in the menu, you know, Indian, Chinese, and Tibetan, and you can order from any of those. But, of course, the best restaurants are the ones that specialize in one or the other.
Sure.
There's also a huge community of Israelis, so there's a lot of Israeli food up there, and I befriended a few of them. We went out to dinner, and I made the mistake of saying that the hummus was okay. They denounced my ability to judge hummus after that point in time, but
why?
I thought it was fine.
Do you know why there's a large community of Israelis in that part of the world?
Well, I know that a lot of them finish their military service, the mandatory service in Israel, and go either to South America or India because they're both like popular destinations for travel. And I know that a lot of Israeli Jews have a soft spot for Buddhism, so they tend to conglomerate in certain cities in India, like the Dharamshala, where the Dalai Lama lives, and Leh up here. But also, just kind of like there becomes a scene, you know, once a group of people keeps going back there every year, and you can see Hebrew written on the signs for some of the restaurants. It's incredible. And similarly now, parts of India are becoming popular with Koreans, actually, which was a real surprise for me. There were a bunch up there in Leh, and especially in Delhi, there's even Korean restaurants and Korean writing on the sides of some buildings.
Hmm.
So as different parts of the world have a burgeoning middle class, I think we'll see a lot more people traveling to India as long as it stays to be, you know, remains very affordable, which it currently is.
And just getting back to one of the first thoughts from the beginning, you mentioned Kashmir, and of course, I immediately think that's a little dangerous region. What are things like there from a political stability sort of standpoint right now?
Well, we debated whether or not when the roads were all closed and they finally opened the first road out, it was through Kashmir, through Srinagar.
Okay.
And because I speak Hindi and I'm not too pale-skinned, my friend and I were saying that I could just sit in the cab and not talk and we'd be fine. But, I mean, that's the kind of attitude. Is people are very wary. We met plenty of Indians and Kashmiris who came through Kashmir and who highly recommended it and said how beautiful it is. It's supposed to be one of the most beautiful cities in the world. But most travelers have the same opinion, which is, well, I'm young and I'll wait until it's a little safer.
Sure. Okay. And it's far enough away that things are – that region you went to is not really impacted as one level removed from that.
No, it's not impacted at all. Okay. In the 30 years since the problems in Kashmir, or however long it's been, there have been no attempts at terrorism in that region because even though the groups that are trying to take over, you know, the borderline in Kashmir have tried to spur some, you know, protests and such in that area, the population there is pretty happy with the government, and it's very mixed. You can find Hindus, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, and Sikhs all living in the same towns there. So it's not like there's, you know, there's just no, what do you call it? There's no room for terrorism in the culture right now.
Interesting. Any final thoughts as we wrap this up? You're going back, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm definitely going back to India. I probably won't go back to Ladakh again for a while. But I would recommend the region. It is so far off the beaten path. It's really difficult to get in and out. So if you're going to go, you have to plan it and leave yourself elbow room. Because even when we were flying in, our flight was delayed 25 hours. And we were put up in a hotel for a night in Delhi. That was because of the weather. And then leaving, it took us 2 full days by car, driving almost every minute of the day. And then we were not still in the valley. And it took us another long 18-hour overnight bus to get to Delhi. So if you are going to be flying in and out of Delhi or Bombay, you really have to plan a lot of time for getting up and into the high Himalayas and back down again. But I think it's worth it. Culturally, it's like Tibet or Nepal, but it's safer and more pure in some ways, but still Indian in others.
Well, thanks very much for being on the show, Sam. I appreciate you sharing both your experiences with us, and then I'll also put links off to your pictures so people can see the beauty of the area as you described it. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks a lot, Chris.
Well, I hope that those of you who have the iTunes enhanced version of the show have been enjoying the pictures there that have been sent by Sam, copyright Sam Oppenheim. And if you didn't see the pictures because you're at the gym or in the car, then go take a look, and I'll put links in the show notes to a gallery that Sam sent me originally, which is the one that made me interested in having him on the show. Sam did also write me an email afterwards with something that he had forgotten. He forgot to mention, he said, that it is a desert region, like Tibet. They get very little rainfall at all, and that's why he was so surprised with the amount of rainfall that actually was washing out the bridges. And he also forgot one of the best stories, he said. After hiking over the passes, 2 days later, still hiking through villages, we were camping, and 12 Russians on bicycles caught up to us. They left on a trip on mountain bikes, hiked up to the pass, then left their mountain bikes there, hiked down and camped, then hiked up with the equipment the next day and biked down, catching up to us. Crazy. I have 2 travel resources for you in today's show. The first one is an article called 10 Budget Travel Myths. Myths like it's always best to spend frequent flyer miles before spending real money. 2, if I stay in a hostel, I'll always have to share a room with strangers. An interesting article. Check out their 10 myths. It's from About's Budget Travel section. And another article from the same website is called Around the World in About $1,300. They point out different ways to get around the world less expensively with an around-the-world trip. Check out that article. Links to that in the enhanced iTunes version of the show or in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. My apologies to the subscribers to the MP3 version of the show, whose part 2 of the New York City show sounded a whole lot like the part 1 repeated. That was my mistake in the feed, and if you check it out now, that's been fixed and you can get the correct version of the show. But again, my apologies, and my thanks to Shimon, who wrote me and pointed out my error so that I was able to fix that. Don't forget to go to the discussion boards, amateurtraveler.com/board, and check out the potential theme song for the show and let me know how you feel about that. Send me any comments at host@amateurtraveler.com. Tell your friends about the show, and if you're particularly bored, Virgin America is a new airline that's starting up in the United States, owned by Richard Branson, who owns Virgin Atlantic and Virgin Records and all of those others. And they're looking to name their planes, and I've suggested the name Amateur Traveler Podcast. I'm not sure that they'll go with it, unless, of course, there's a groundswell of support. But check out the link to that and the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. Thanks so much for listening. This episode was brought to you by Hotelbook.com, which features nearly 5,000 unique and independent hotels in more than 140 countries. Whether it's a resort, a cabana, or a castle, Hotelbook.com invites you to stay your way and stay independent. Visit Hotelbook.com to see the latest destination deals, with rates from $60 a night. From an upscale city hotel to a relaxing beach retreat, Hotelbook.com will show you the best deals for that one-of-a-kind travel experience. Hotelbook.com. Stay independent.
the best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Pod Show, and Limelight.